If you're listening to the journey, it wasn't, hey, I had an idea, leave the company, go make this happen. It was taking my skill set that I had, getting out of the support mechanism of the corporate world, which is truly not an entrepreneurial world at all, as you know.
Guided by over 25 years in the data and research industry and assisting innovators with investment banking and advisory services, Seema Vasa brings you Data Gurus, a leading market research podcast that offers actionable insights for business acceleration and value creation. Join her as she speaks with key innovators in the space to bring you up to speed with the current state and the future of data analytics and data ecosystems. This is Data Gurus. Need support on your market research projects? Paradigm Sample is a full-service market research solutions provider. Whether you need help with questionnaire design, survey programming, or online data collection, we are ready to assist. Paradigm can do as little or as much as you need, saving you time so that you can focus on insights. Learn more at paradigmsample.com.
Welcome to another episode of Data Gurus. I'm so excited to welcome Rick West, who is the co-founder and CEO of Field Agent. Welcome, Rick.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited about today. We've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. So I know you have such an amazing experience in this industry. I would just love it. And I don't want to minimize your journey, but if you could just give listeners just a little bit of the highlights of your journey that got you to the point of founding, co-founding Field Agent.
Sure. I came from the corporate world. So I spent 17 years with Procter & Gamble. For most of the people listening now would say, that's great. And the other 50% great, the other 50% are rolling their eyes. Great training ground, classic training, would not have traded it for the world. Spent time in the US. My final 3 years of the company were in Asia, a couple of years in Hong Kong, a year in Bangkok. And that was truly an entrepreneurial experience within a corporate umbrella, funded by the corporation. But it was just from Indonesia to Jakarta, and then you're in Australia, then you're back up in the Philippines. But it really was this entrepreneurial thing. And I had to make the decision, am I going to come back into that true corporate machine in Cincinnati, Ohio, the home office, or am I going to go out and do something on my own? And I had a good friend of mine, Henry Ho, that lived here. This is Rick, this Northwest Arkansas bubble, this vendor community for Walmart is unlike anything you've seen. I think we could take what we've learned from P&G and go create something for every other vendor that's here. And that's what really got me out of the corporate world into this entrepreneurial. But that was a classic lifestyle business. You can only grow as fast as I could attend meetings. I mean, it was founder-led driven. And then about 10 years after that, this little thing called, the iPhone 3S came out. And it was the rage. It'd be the rage being that, let's call it what it is. Front-facing camera was great, 2 megapixel, no video yet, but it was fantastic. And we were trying to use that technology to capture pictures inside of a store because my wife, who also worked for Procter, was running a research business and she's flying all over the US to do intercepts in stores and engaging people. And we're just road warriors. And we've been sending digital cameras out to people, everything we could do. We said, wait a minute, we're all holding this little computer. And at that point in time, the business model for an app was to get someone to download it, get eyes on it, have them click an ad.
Yeah.
And we said, I wonder with PayPal and other things, if we could convince someone to download an app and take a picture for us. And they did. It was crazy. This is 2 months before Uber launched. The gig economy wasn't a thing. And so at that point in time, it was purely a tool for our marketing business and for our research business. And after about a year, we realized that we could scale this. This is something we really should focus on. So if you're listening to the journey, it wasn't, hey, I had an idea, leave the company, go make this happen. It was taking my skill set that I had, getting out of the support mechanism of the corporate world, which is truly not an entrepreneurial world at all, as you know.
Yes.
And once you got a taste of it and you really opened your eyes to the problems you could solve, the question was not if you were going to do it, it's which one of the problems were you going to solve at scale?
Right.
And this was the one, and the rest is history.
That's fascinating. So number one, 17 years at Procter & Gamble, and then taking that step to starting a company is no easy feat. You're comfortable, you're secure, you know how to play the game. Was it something inside of you that just says, I have to do this? Or like, what made you take that first step?
I think for me personally, and my co-founders, my wife may say something a little bit different because we all kind of left the corporate world. I think my taste of independence within Asia that let me know, not only could I do this, I just felt like I was made to go make this thing work. And this is the thing that corporate America doesn't allow, especially in big companies, doesn't allow you to do. I had underestimated what relationships and connections look like, because in the US, you were somewhat insulated in this big corporate bubble. Well, you get out into these other countries and you realize it's all about relationships. It's just about getting things done. And I was really good at that. Just the connection, I thought, okay, that's a skill set I've started to acquire. I really should do this on my own because I'm really good at it, as opposed to going back to the corporate world and trying to do that internally, the same kind of machine. And so I felt really good about it. So that was number one. I think the second thing was, it's tough when you get a taste, and this is for anyone that's thinking about changing and moving into something, when you get a taste of true autonomy, where you really can call the shots and make a difference, it's hard to go back. And I had that when I was in Hong Kong and I was in these countries. I could leave a country, know I made it better. I made decisions on the fly. And I knew coming back to the corporate world, that wasn't going to be the case. And so I just didn't want to go backwards.
Yeah, that's absolutely understandable. And you're right. It's like when you get to control your time, be able to make decisions, and not all of them are right. I would say if you're 50%, that's really good.
Funny story. Here's our launch date from leaving P&G.
Yeah.
First day, we've got clients ready. We're flying to Orlando. I have to go through Memphis to connect. As we're walking off the plane, our flight gets canceled.
Right.
We're going to be late for our very first customer call. We have no money. Right. We're staying with friends at Orlando. We go into a cafe to get a cup of coffee, and we watch the second plane hit the World Trade Center.
Oh, my gosh.
So our launch date was September 1st. Our first trip was 9/11. So for 6 months, I've got family members and friends saying, so are you going to make it? Are you going to go back to PM? What are you going to do? So it was a fairly humbling experience, no fault of our own, to realize, what have I done? But if you believe in the solution you're providing,
right?
If you believe in what you're, it just delayed things, but it was a tough 6 months or so.
I bet there was probably a lot of soul searching and wait, did I make the right decision? Is this the right way? Sad time in history, but it's amazing that you guys persevered.
Yeah. And we had really cool funding. Okay, I don't want to monopolize. You have great questions you're going to ask me. Let me tell you funding.
Okay.
So I've been trying to coach a few people along this path. When we left Procter, instead of taking 3 months, enjoying ourselves, taking vacations,
right,
we used our corporate package money as seed money. And the beautiful thing about that seed money, they didn't get shares, they didn't get options, and they weren't sitting on our board. So I'm telling people today is that you're with a company and then you're let go, but you're going to get 3 months severance, 6 months severance. Take that $20, $50, $80, $100,000, go invest in your business as opposed to asking me for $100,000, and I'm going to give it to you with strings attached and other things. And I've had people say, but I was going to go to Europe for the summer. I said, you can. But this is a windfall of entrepreneurial cash coming to you that you're never going to have this chance again, because the next time you ask for it, it's really tough. So that was also how we kept things going, is that we used that as seed money.
Right. And I think what I always tell people, a relationship with an investor or even co-founder, it really is like a marriage. Like you never, there's good days and there's bad days, but you are committed to making it work. And so your point of, use your seed money. If you're getting a package, use it well and wisely, because you can start that journey without not just dealing with building your business, but then also dealing with an external party that you might or might not know that.
And here's a little trade trip trick here that if I say this, I don't think the statute of limitations are way gone from me getting in trouble, but I think you're right. For example, in most packages like that, you get education training, correct?
Yes.
So we took the education money and we went to our accountant and our lawyer, said, hey, we need a half day training on how to write operating agreements, on how to write MSAs. We need a half day training. Can you bill us for billable hours on setting up a P&L? And so the education money helped fund the infrastructure, as opposed to me going to a lawyer paying $200-$300 an hour. They simply charged me a billable hour for a four-hour education piece. And we all four sat through the education.
Yeah, that's smart.
So it's being creative with the funds, because the company really wants to help you, but they think, oh, I'm going to help you get educated towards your MBA, or maybe you want to be a realtor. But why wouldn't you use the education to train you as an entrepreneur? So there's some very creative ways to have your corporate entity help you if you've got that opportunity.
That's fantastic. That is a creative way of doing it. I had not thought of that particular idea, but it's fantastic. Tell me, where are you with Field Agent? I'm sure its mission has evolved.
A little bit, yeah.
Kind of give us an idea of where you operate. And I know you had some other activities. You acquired a business in Europe, but let's start with, where is Field Agent today and its mission?
Today, we've had, I think, three acquisitions over the last X number of years, most recently in the fall. We acquired a company in France. It was called Simply Field. Luckily, the number had Field in it. The name had Field in it, which is pretty cool. But that acquisition allowed us to continue to operate within a similar ICP, but different verticals. So in our world today, if you do work at retail, whether it's omnichannel,
sure,
brick and mortar, or you're doing retail work that's related to staffing, mm-hmm, you know, projects, we have a crowd of almost 3 million people in 7 countries that can actually do micro tasks in 3 categories: quantitative yes, no answers in store.
Okay.
Qualitative mystery shopping research in the middle. And then we've got sampling and ratings and reviews, kind of micro influence on the other side. Simply Field gave us a fourth vertical, which is, if you want to use your own employees or your own contractors, then Simply Field, the SaaS platform, drops in and lets you do checklist micro task management with that software. So if you're a retailer and you're trying to understand competition, or if you're a brand and you're trying to understand what's going on in store or online, or if you're an apparel or a high-end beauty and you're trying to manage your beauty assistants at scale, we can take care of you soup to nuts. And so that's kind of the business ecosystem we live in today. Most people look at Field Agent specifically as that crowdsourcing company that provides great quality data back into the company to help them understand. And what we've been able to do, or really even over the last 6 months, is to take the scale that we have, and instead of being transactional, we can allow you to do now like a virtual store walk, where you can go look back at categories 6 months ago, and I can show you new items that have changed, how share of shelf has changed, heat mapping where people are looking at the shelf. So we've now gone from very transactional to allowing you to have a virtual store walk that really is a syndicated data look at categories. And so that's where we are today in our business model.
And how granular do you get? Can you do it at a store level when you look at a heat map, or is it?
Yeah, we can go down to the shelf level. So I can tell you heat, I can show you the shelf, and I can show you within the shelf where they're looking.
Okay. All right.
Because when they're taking the photo, looking at the shelf, and so that's the heat map piece of it. But what's important for us is that if you can get public access to a location, from a commercial building to a brick and mortar retailer, we can get access with people. Within that access, we can send a generic people to capture quantitative, but sending in me, I'm going to send you to Sephora. And when you go to Sephora, not only are you going to capture quantitative, I'm going to ask you your opinion. If there's an out of stock, what would you buy? Or when you engage the beauty advisor, what did they recommend? And while you're there, I'm going to say, hey, would you be interested in buying and trying a product? And I'm going to reimburse you for the product. And would you either post about it, write a ratings and review, or give me research on how you used it in your home? So our photo that we take is more than a photo quantitative. It's qualitative, because I've got a female 18 to 45 data on it. And I'm having you try a product while you're there. And I've got great data. So if you're looking at our ICP, one photo and one engagement takes care of a brand person, a market research person, and an operations person all in one transaction.
It's fascinating. It really is. And when you look at the pictures, I'm sure you have technology that allows you to analyze those pictures at scale.
Right. So let's speak to the virtual store walk we have. It's a product called Retail Pipelines. And we've partnered with a company that's called ShelfGram. And with machine learning and AI, those two things come together and create amazing visuals for us. So the machine learning, as you can imagine, if you've ever done any photo recognition, it's how do you train the photos? It's the classic AI model today, but I think last year we took like 5 million photos. I mean, so it's training of retail photos coming in. So that's machine learning. Then we take the AI part of that and say, okay, if this was here before and this is not, therefore give you an alert or a recommendation that said, hey, I know you might not be looking for this, but on this category within Target, there's now two new items in Phoenix. Because the AI can look for things. Now, you've got to set the rules up. As we know, AI is not that special, but you've got to set the rules, have it put in. But it really is allowing someone to get away from spreadsheets and flipping through photos. Have a dashboard that gives you proactive information as opposed to reactive information you asked for. We're starting to push it out. And that's been really cool. And it's happened for us really over the last 6-9 months that we've been developing this. And AI has really helped us kind of move that along.
That's fantastic. Do retailers mind when people are in the store taking pictures?
Let's talk about the early days.
Okay.
The early days when virtually every person I talked to had a BlackBerry and they would hold the phone up and say, Rick, how are you going to train them to take the photos? And once they take the photos, how are they going to upload it to their computer to send it to you? As opposed to not understanding what an iPhone would do. At the same time, you've got people with signs in the store saying, you can't take photos, can't take photos. And I can remember we were at a Walmart meeting. They brought vendors in and they asked us to come in and present because of the work we were doing with them. And one person said, hey, I thought you've got a sign up that says no photos. And she said, if I see you in with a 35 millimeter camera, or if I see a news crew in, we're going to escort them out. She said, but we're putting QR codes on our products and we're asking people to use their phone. And you can hear the whole crowd say, oh. So in today's world, outside of maybe a very rural town, where someone at the Dollar General would think your management's taking pictures to see what they're doing. I can't tell you in the last 2-3 years that we've had any complaint anywhere where someone's ever been questioned. From the selfies to the checking, and we want you to take pictures. So it's such a different world today than it was even 3-4 years ago. So it's really just kind of a non-issue right now because it's just the way people expect you to do business.
It's society. We all use it, and it's not a question anymore as to why your phone is out. So what is the biggest pain point for brands as it relates to understanding the retail dynamics and how you guys solve for that?
I think for us in the world of big data, most people know the what. People have more data than you know what to do with. I mean, it's just crazy, right? The amount of data. And so let's use an out of stock as an easy example for us. I know that I've got a beauty item that sells 2 units per store per week, and I've got a consumable laundry product that sells 100 items a week.
Okay.
And the machine's going and I'm looking at 20,000 data points across the United States. And all of a sudden my errors come up and say, wait a minute, this item is now scanning 2 versus 4, or it's scanning 20 versus 100. And you're like, well, I guess that's a problem, but why? I'll come in and tell you by getting someone to go in same day and near real time.
Yeah.
People will give me an API feed that says, here's my problem. I go out immediately in a store and say the tag was down. Okay. You have an out of stock. You have phantom inventory. Okay. Your signage came down. Your display is so beautiful, but the person in the store is putting your competitor's product in the display. So one of the biggest pain points they have is the why. Why is something going on? The second thing is most people are experts in a store, but it's only the store you can drive to that's 15 minutes away. With the scale and the expectations and the reduced labor that retailers have today, they expect the brands and the salespeople to be experts. And we provide them a virtual store walk of hundreds and hundreds of locations. So I can tell you across every major market what the dairy display looks like at Whole Foods. Or I can tell you exactly in every Sephora exactly what they're featuring. I'm sure this is how all the stores, every Whole Foods is a snowflake. They're all completely different. And I can tell you today, you could pull up a screen and I'd say, what store do you want? Well, I want to look at the store in Austin. We pull up the store in Austin and we're just literally virtually walking through the store. That's the power of this machine learning and AI within this retail pipeline tool we have. Because the biggest issue that brands have, they don't have near real-time data and they can't see it to come up with why something's going on. And that's what we provide for them.
When you provide that information, I'm always curious, how quickly does a brand respond?
Okay, so if there's a fire, okay, they're responding pretty quick. So from the retail pipeline standpoint, when you've got this proactive data, I normally don't hear too much feedback unless we're doing a quarterly or monthly review where they're like, oh my gosh, it saved me here, it saved me there. Obviously, any type of project that we're doing, when someone's out in a store, they realize there's a problem or they see something online or something's happening, we get pretty quick feedback there. What we found is that because the scale that we have, what are you going to do with 10,000 photos? So the machine learning piece that we have, even within the field agent dashboard, allows you to sort by, show me all the locations that an agent said something was wrong. So I go from 10,000 stores to 500. And then based on the reason code wrong, show me all the ones that were missing price tag, and it shows me 50. Then export that, send it to my third party and go fix it. So we're able to take quantity and break it into manageable tasks. And so that's the way we're getting the feedback. If not, I would be doing a project, send it to them. It would be sitting and I know it would never be opened. They're never going to get to it. So dashboards, machine learning, the AI pieces coming along really makes this a usable tool. And the last thing we want to do is to have someone pay for data and not use it. I mean, what a waste.
I totally agree. And likely if they're not using it, it's not going to be renewed or in the next time period or whatnot. Right. Curious, do you guys ever participate in new item introductions? Because I know that's always a major pain point of doing new item introductions and test markets, and like it's crickets, right? Like those early days, very hard to understand like what is actually happening. I know there's companies that put QR codes or coupons inside the product to say, hey, tell me a little bit of what you think of this product, but curious your perspective on that.
So let's take, I'll do a CPG and a quick serve restaurant. I'll do both of those as a quick serve restaurant's more of an LTO, limited time offer. And then you've got a Unilever Kraft that says, hey, I'm doing a major planogram reset. So a Unilever P&G would come to us and say, I'd like to send in 200 or 300 people of this demographic, and I want them to shop the category, and I need to understand these 15, 20 insights. Then 4 weeks later, after everything's been reset, then we'll send the same 200 people back in and say, shop the category, answer the same questions. And so we're getting pre and post. And that's tied to a new item because they're trying to understand without, especially, you know, listen, you've dealt in the research world, you get this. You don't want to lead someone. And we're trying to say, what do you see that's different? What you want them to say is, oh my goodness, I've just noticed there's really cool new items here, or something's new, or this packaging has changed in a very unaided way. What's interesting is that if I take the pre and they might be talking about, oh, I saw the signage, but when you do the post, then they gravitate to the product, then I know something's popping. So we do a lot of pre and post type of things for new items. The other piece is, in most cases, you've got a limited time, even within big box retail, of a 6-week window that you've got promotion dollars, displays, and then they're flipping on you again. And what we're able to do from a pure audit standpoint is that if you're, I don't know, there's 4,700 Walmarts and you get 2,500 displays, we know that every day matters. So if your displays hit on the first, on the second, we're going to check all 2,500 stores and tell you if those displays are up. Because oftentimes, from an execution standpoint, it could take weeks and you could lose a third to a half of your promotion period because displays stayed in the background. So that's how we handle it. Quick serve restaurants a little bit different because you've got these LTOs all the time. And what they're trying to understand is, did their stores execute with excellence? So go buy this item, open up the package, show me what it looks like. Was it warm? What did they put in? How was it presented? What words? It's more of a mystery shopping. We've probably given away 10,000 pizzas this year of just food that's all the time, but it's every 30 days. It's a new item that they're coming in. So that's been really cool. It's been fun for our agents, but also for the Little Caesars of the world or the Papa John's. They're coming in and saying, wow, I can get amazing feedback. And since it's near real time, I can get you feedback to a store while that LTO is still running. See, most big pieces of research, you get a report 30 days after it's over. Well, I'm giving you data while it's going on. And that's mind-blowing that a store manager can know that they're just missing it a little, or it's not quite presented the right way. And that's been pretty fun.
And you can actually, when you think about it, like even identify it by day part and figure out who was working that day.
That's exactly right. We do a lot of shift work that way. You can only buy this between 4 and 8, or you can only buy this between 10 and 2, because they're trying to understand the crews on how they executed. You're exactly right. Yeah.
So you mentioned this in earlier part of our conversation, omnichannel. Talk to me about how that's impacted your business in terms of, we've talked a lot about a brick and mortar, being in the store, being in the restaurant, quick serve restaurant. How does the non-brick and mortar channels fit into your model?
Yeah, what we don't do, it's probably you said what we don't do first. I'm not tracking clicks and I'm not tracking eye movement and I'm not following the mouse. I mean, there's all kinds of companies that do that. Where we really got into Omnicom and it really started to drive into our world was over COVID.
Yeah.
When delivery and pickup became mainstay.
Okay.
Now imagine you're a retailer and you're trying to understand from a competitive standpoint what all of your competitors are doing related to pickup and delivery. And we're going out having our agents do pickup and delivery, videoing the transaction, taking pictures of every facet, measuring exactly the minutes to the time that it takes. So instead of thinking, oh, on average, it takes 3 minutes before someone greets you, I can tell you it was actually 1 minute and 32 seconds. I've got the iPhone that captures that metadata.
And you had people going out during COVID?
Because you couldn't get third parties to go in because workers had to stay out, but we all still had to buy food. So while you're shopping, we could still engage. And then for the people that didn't want to go to the stores, they wanted to have all these deliveries.
Right.
And your retailer says, yeah, I know there's this little DoorDash thing and I might play.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, you're Kroger and you're like, well, I have to not only understand it, but this is probably going to be a post-COVID thing. I better do the research to understand what's happening with that. So when it comes to pickup, delivery, and that omni-channel experience there, we do a ton of work in that space. When it comes to sampling, we can ship samples to someone, which is not what we do. We tell our clients, wait a minute, what if we have them buy the product, put it into their basket, have it delivered to their home, so that now that item's actually in their basket and you know it's in their basket and you can go after them again. And then that sample comes to them. So let's reimburse them for that product, as opposed to sending it randomly to 100 homes. You have no idea who the demographic is. So I know who these people are. If you're L'Oreal and you're trying to go after Revlon, I'm going to find you women that buy Revlon. And the reason I know they buy Revlon is because I ask them to take a picture of their beauty counter and show me all the mascara they have, and they validated their Revlon. So I'm only sending samples of L'Oreal or maybe something else to them. They're like, oh my gosh, Rick, I'm not wasting samples, just sending them. And so that's how we're involved in the e-com omnichannel piece, because we still do that online piece, because now it's in your basket. You can recommend that they buy it again, but we're also doing classic research.
Have you met a lot of the people that are your field agents?
A few. We've got stories of engagement rings.
They're part of your DNA, right? They are.
They really are. It's from engagement rings to, we've interviewed one. She actually has a podcast now where she had a severe bout of Crohn's disease, single mom. And she said, Rick, field agent literally fed my child for about 3 months. Yeah. So you have just heartbreaking stories where we help. And then someone's taking a cruise or they're buying an engagement ring. It varies. It's something that we're doing unique now. My wife, the researcher, actually has an event space here in Northwest Arkansas, where companies are sending in their large products. So a outdoor dining or outdoor seating, jewelry, TV screens, where you can't simply send 100 TV screens out, too expensive. And so in that event center, we now have hundreds of people coming in doing product reviews before an item is launched. And so we're getting complete engagement with people today, unlike we've ever done before. So it's really fun to see the stories. And then with our client success and customer success folks, they get cards, you get birthday cards and Christmas cards. So it's really kind of fun.
Yeah. In the online world and in the, like, say, quantitative research or qualitative research, the incentives are so different depending on the research objective, the length of interview for qual, if it's digital qual or if you're coming into a center. What is the incentive model, kind of the rubric around how field agents get compensated or rewarded.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you're talking to a hardcore researcher or a panel provider, the interesting thing is we get about 5,000 organic downloads a week. If any mommy blogger or a penny-pinching blogger writes about us, we'll get 30, 40,000 downloads this week.
Holy moly.
If you research or Google anything about how do you make money with your phone, we're always the top one, two, or three that have been vetted and you can make real money. So that's number one. The second thing is, because this is while you shop and while you go, we do not have to pay and maintain a panel. So I'm not trying to keep 2 million people active. On any given month, I'm keeping 200,000 people active. I mean, it's still a crazy number, but I don't have to keep all 2 million because I'm not trying to provide a representative sample to a sampling group over here. And then the payment aspect of it, you're never going to become the mayor of field agent. You're not going to get a badge and you're not going to get points. It's pure cash. So for a person inside of their home to answer a question on how they store products or what they do inside of their home, that's going to cost you $3 or $4 per complete, roughly. If you have someone go out to a store and they're engaging at that time, it's going to be $10 to $15 per complete. It's going to include photos, video. We're pretty good about not having them be exhausted. We're not going to have them answer 30 questions. We do a nice job. Then when you start getting into ratings and reviews and other things, it's probably closer to $20, $25 a complete because you're going to do some follow-up. We're going to understand if they would buy the product later. So there's a little bit more complexity there. And then in most cases, that agent is going to receive anywhere from 40 to 60% of what I charge you. So the average person is making $1 or $2 at home, $5 to $10 out in a store. And I think last year, the record for us was around $20,000 that someone made last year.
Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
The average person is probably making $10, $15 a week.
Still.
Because I'm out. I was going to go to Kroger, but Safeway was here. I was going to go to Target, but I can make $10 at Walmart. Or I'm traveling to Virginia to see my family. And I could go to Love's. But wait a minute. I could go to Pilot, make $10. Because all Pilot wants me to do is say, was that greeted at the door and were the bathrooms clean?
That's amazing. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of how our economy works. And so the average person making a little bit of cash, but if you want to receive the free beer that we're going to give you for sampling it, that we provide, that you want to offer the eat our pizza or our food, and you want to actually engage in the products and the way we're doing things, and you check the app two or three times a day, there are people that are making $25, $50 a day just between lunch and on their way home.
It's the gig economy. It's part of their gig.
It's the gig economy. Most college and young people are saying, I want to do this just enough to keep paying for my new iPhone. If I can make $30 or $40 a month, then I'm going to keep getting a new phone and this thing's going to pay for it. And so it's interesting how many people say, oh, I only do this enough to pay for my phone.
Yeah, exactly. That's fantastic. Rick, I want to get your take on AI. You're already using it. There's an explosion around generative AI. What's your perspective in terms of its role in the industry and particularly your business? I'm sure you've thought about it clearly from your business perspective.
Yeah. So let's get into the infrastructure or the internal operations of any business in general. I think we're naive to think that for me to come up with content, and then I have to come up with 20 different versions of one-liners based on the content I've created, so I can do A/B testing on ads, would have taken me X hours. And today, I still tell our team, I still want you creating original content, but for AI to give me 20 examples of that to quickly A/B test, oh my. I mean, just crazy the amount of time. And then the same way for photos, we do the original creative. We're not trying to pull anything off. We've got four or five different versions. And now I say, okay, I need these sizes. And it's just amazing how quickly that our design creative content team is using that. On the customer service side, it's all the stuff you expect. It's becoming cleaner and better. It's pretty typical. Now, when you look at the data model that we have, I think it's just making it more human-like with the responses. It's still me with the algorithms and putting things in place to say, look for this and do that. But the engagement that we're getting from our clients, like, well, that just felt so much better. And I wouldn't say that we figured it out yet, to be honest with you, but we're getting better and better about really having that interface feel different as to what we're doing today. And I think when you look at the world of the big data we're living in today, if you're willing to use your own data set, and in our case, we're big enough that we can use our own data set. So I'm not sending my clients' data out. We're actually, we brought things in and we're running our data set. We're getting pretty smart. And it's been really cool to see the scale of which we're getting smarter on the nuances on data, how we now show data differently, the types of questions we weren't even thinking about asking. And now the AI tells, oh my gosh, I would have never thought about that. So I think it's making us better. So if I was coaching someone, I would say, A, you have to be engaged in it. You can't not be. But I think it's going to make you better. But if you let it just kind of go off on its own, I think it's, you're really doing a disservice to your customers, to your clients, and to your team, because I don't know how you're going to take that and scale it in the right way, because you're always one engagement off from doing something really stupid. So you just, I keep telling myself, I said, you start to look at it. You can't let this thing go. So I think for anyone that's in the space, especially around data, it's just mandatory. And for your internal teams, even something as simple as when a salesperson sends out a recap, we say, just run it through AI, just run it through ChatGPT, and it cleans it up a little bit. It's the best editor I've got as far as helping me, as opposed to saying, here's three sentences, write something for me. I said, I don't need you to go that route. So it's been a good enabler for us.
Yeah. Well, and I think what you said is spot on, like, be responsible, test it. It's not like if you're point A, you're going to get to point Z without playing and dabbling and refining and experimenting what you're ultimately trying to achieve. And I actually think we're never, quote unquote, going to be there, because it feels like technology is just going to continue to evolve.
I think so. But another thing, we just had our first RFP 3 weeks ago or so. That was the first time that they asked about AI.
Interesting.
And whereas the past, it would have been, what technology, how do you do X? And now they're saying, hey, I need to know how you're using AI. Yeah. You know, okay, what specific brands are you using? It's like even they're trying to understand from a business standpoint, but I also think there's also a purchasing legal standpoint to make sure they understand what we're doing, privacy, et cetera. To leave that box blank could be the kiss of death on an RFP. So you have to have some positioning to get past that hurdle. So my expectation is in the next year, I think everyone's going to ask that question. What are you using? How are you using it? What are your legal restraints, constraints? What are your agreements? You know, how are you handling liability? So you're going to have to stick your head in there.
I totally agree. And it's fun. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. And I look forward to keeping in touch with you.
Oh, it's been a blast. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Data Gurus podcast, brought to you by Infinity Squared. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Tired of market research solutions that put your project in a box? At Paradigm Sample, we approach market research support with customized and consultative solutions. Whether you need help with questionnaire design, survey programming, or online data collection, we're ready to assist. Let us know your needs, and we can customize a solution just for you. Learn more at ParadigmSample.com.